help me welcome our speaker tonight, Gina from Bristol Beginners.
Hi, my name is Gina. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Gina.
My sobriety date is November 30th, 2007. And I came to Alcoholics Anonymous to the point where, like, when they talk about the gift of desperation, like, that's how I got here. I'm a girl that came in and out, in and out, in and out constantly. I kept thinking that my way was going to work, that nobody else's could tell me what to do. I didn't want to follow anybody else's rules. You know, I just wanted to run my own show. I'm born and raised in Philly. I'm a middle child. My parents divorced when I was, you know, like, probably like 5 or 6. And I probably was the only thing that was the biggest tornado in my house was me. I created havoc no matter where we went, what we did. In school, I was always in the principal's office. My desk was always in the front of the room. The teacher said sit, I stood. You know, like just one of them kids that I was just defiant and I didn't like authority. And like looking back, I can see it, like it's always like about my pride and ego, like who are you talking to? I used to think that like even as a young age, like if you said anything to me, it was like I was weak if I gave in and if I didn't fight back all the time. And I don't really know where that came from. My parents divorced and I've never seen them fight. Like they didn't do any of that stuff in front of us. I didn't even know my mom drank wine or smoked cigarettes until I was like 8th grade. You know, like that's what kind of house I came from. And but I was the kid who just, my brother and my sister, I have a younger brother and older sister, and like they didn't want to be in, they weren't allowed in the house by themselves with me because I just was really abusive and just really out of control all the time. And you know, my mom used to say to me, like, I don't know how you are in the outside world that you have friends, but you are just so mean on the inside of this house. And I really was. I think I was, must have been about 7. My mom would tell you, she's like, Gina, you said to me, what kind of woman are you that your husband leaves you? I told her she was pathetic. I was 7, you know? So, I was the gem. And, you know, like, it just continued on and on through my journey through, you know, grade school and everything. And I took my first drink when I was 13. We used to go to my dad's house on the weekends. And my sister's 2 years older than me, so he was like, if you want to go out, then you have to take Gina with you, which she was not very happy about, but she did. And, you know, I took my first drink, and I was around, like, a bunch of older people, and it just made me feel free, and, like, I became alive, and I loved it. I loved every second of it. And when I was, like an idiot, it gave me an excuse, right? So that way I could be like, oh, I was drunk, I didn't know what I did, you know? Or the things that I said to people or how I treated them, it kind of just gave me an excuse all the time. And that continued. And then the one time I got really drunk and I drank a few of Jack Daniels. And I came home with one shoe on and I threw up over my dad's feet. And my sister got, like, she got beat. I got punished for 6 months, but I only lived with my dad, like, on the weekend. So I knew that wasn't going to last. So the only thing I really learned was that me and Jack Daniels don't get along and I probably should drink something else, you know, like it wasn't my thing. And I did that too. I was the one who, you know, I would try different things, different types of alcohol, whether it was liquor or beer, whatever worked. Or, you know, if I drank vodka, I was fist fighting in the middle of the street, so I decided not to do that. Like, you know what I mean? I kept moving around to figure out which one, like, would fit my needs, you know, which one I would get drunk faster with, you know, different beers, different things. And I was like, I was in 8th grade, and I used to think that everybody drank the same exact way as me. And then I realized that, like, not everybody was saving up all their chore money to go, you know, climb the fence to go drink jungle juice in the cemetery on Friday nights, you know. My mom used to go down Tarsdale Avenue in Philly, and she would, like, check all the playgrounds for me and my sister, because we were always where we were not supposed to be, drinking 40s, getting in trouble, doing whatever, and, you know, there was this group of kids that hung out at this corner, and my parents told me I was not allowed on this corner. So, you know, I had to hang on that corner. And I got me a boyfriend that lived on that corner. And, you know, I was in high school, and half of the people there, which I don't have anything against anybody, but, like, they didn't leave, like, 8th grade, and they were just out robbing and stealing and, like, fixing cars and just living their best lives and riding quads all day. And I just thought that was amazing, and I had to get up and go to school every day, you know? So, like, I would go back and, like, I would go to school, and then at nighttime I'd hang out in the corner, drink, do my thing, whatever. And, my relationship was very toxic. I was young and he was a lot older than me, and it just was really toxic. And I stayed in it for 4 years, not knowing anything else, not knowing any different, very low self-esteem, and just wanted to be with someone, if that makes any sense. Probably very codependent. And but I graduated high school, and I graduated from that relationship to go and hang on the corner and go out robbing and stealing all day long. Like, all my dreams came true, right? I got to do whatever I wanted to. And my mom thought I was in Philadelphia Community College. I probably only went for 3 weeks, but she really wanted to know how I did on my report card. And I was like, oh, I stopped going there like a month ago. She was like, where have you been every day? And I was like, oh, I'm on the corner, you know? You know, I hung out, and we would go out and steal laptop computers and camcorders from Radio Shacks and Silos, because that's my age, you know? And so, you know, we did that. We would go to, and like at nighttime, we were so stupid. Like, we would literally like go to empty parking lots, like this, the old Superfresh and stuff. And we would like wait for the car. Our friend would drive by the car to see if we could jump in it fast enough, just in case we had to do a getaway. Like, just stupid. Like, and we thought we were prepared for everything. And, anyway, I was really intoxicated in the back of a car one time, like over my limit, and like I passed out. But I woke up to this female cop. She ripped me out of the car, and I had this man screaming at me that it was me that tried to steal his car. And I'm trying to talk and explain to him that I don't even know how to drive, let alone steal your car. But I was so drunk I couldn't get the words out. So whatever. I woke up in the roundhouse down in Philly, and I went in front of a judge, and I signed my own bail. My mom came and got me. And it was like that New Year's Eve. And I wasn't even like out of high school for a year yet. My mom was like, it's been like 6 months. Are you serious? You know? And, so, you know, I stayed home. My brother was, you know, was younger than me. So my mom went out with her friends. And so me and my brother and a couple of his friends, we just hung out at my house and drank my adult 2020, you know? And I still got my way. So I still got drunk. So it didn't really matter to me. And, 2 weeks later, I got arrested in a different county, for stealing laptop computers. And I remember they weren't just letting me sign my own bail. Like, it wasn't that simple. And I knew I was in a lot of trouble. And so when I finally got home, everybody in my neighborhood is like, you should go to rehab because judges really like that. And I was like, oh, I can do that, you know. So I did. I went to my first rehab. I was 18 years old, and I was in trouble for talking to the boys. You know, like, I didn't have a reason. They kept talking about the 12 steps. And there was like this, like a hall that they did the meetings at, and it had steps. I kept thinking that they were the steps, the 12 steps, were the ones that you walk down to go to this meeting hall. And I was like, I don't understand what these people are talking about. Because I didn't pay attention. I really kept thinking that it was a phase, and I didn't need to be there because I was really just there so it looked good for court. And I had a retired nun that was my therapist, so we got along really well. And she did not like me, and I was always in trouble. And I did complete the program, and I went home, and I remember going to outpatient for like 3 weeks. And everybody was older than me, and they had kids, and they were talking about like all their problems and things that they had to do. And I just felt so lost. Like, I'm just 18. I don't have all of this stuff, and I don't know what to do with myself on a Friday night. And I'll never forget, the therapist looked at me dead serious and was like, well, you could fly a kite in the park. And I was like, is this real life right now? Like, who does that? I was like, nobody does that anymore. Like, so, you know, I eventually just went back to drinking, you know, and, you know, I was still living at my mom's house, and she was not happy with my drinking. And like, I would dib and dab with other, you know, forms of alcohol. And, but I strictly stayed with alcohol majority of the time. And, I just kept, you know, coming home. I would come home, and then somebody would call me and say, dude, come back out. And I would go back out, you know, and I really wasn't working or anything. So my mom was, like, over me, and then I finally got a job, and I loved my job. But I also found people that worked at my job that drank just like me, right, like a magnet. And so I didn't mind going to work, because if we got done work early, we all went and drank, right? So that was worked out. It was fine for me, too. And so eventually, you know, one night I'm so out of my mind, my mom locks the door and she's like, you're not welcome in my home anymore. Like, you gotta go. And my first thought was, oh my God, what am I gonna do? My second thought was like, I'm good. You know what I mean? Like, so I just found friends, and I lived on their sofas and did my thing and went to work. Me and my best friend got an apartment, and I went to work. I still drank every night, and I went to my second rehab, and when I got out, I turned 21, so of course my brother and them, my brother was younger than me, but they had a big keg party for me. And like, my mom used to ask me if I was the girl, so you know, I'm from Philly, so there's like all the prisons on State Road down there. So my mom used to ask me if I stood outside of the prisons to wait for my new boyfriends, because they always seemed to be like the bottom of the barrel, the worst of the worst. And I like look back now and I feel like if they were really, like the worst reputation they had, it like gave me a name, if that makes any sense. It was like I arrived, and the more messed up they were, the more I could fix them and I didn't have to look at myself, you know? And, so anyway, my brother would, dib and dab and hustle for them. So I was the sister that if you, robbed my little brother, that I robbed you to get back at you for robbing my brother, you know? And my brother would come find me and he would be like, what did you do last night? And I'd be like, nothing. What are you talking about? And he's like, so-and-so's missing, like, their stereo equipment or whatever. And I'd be like, I don't know what you're talking about. And nobody was going to come up and ask me, because that's even more embarrassing that I robbed you, right? So, but anyway, and the reason why I say that is because 2 months after my 21st birthday, my little brother was high on PCP and some Xanaxes, and he hung himself on his way home. He got arrested for some disorderly conduct thing, and he hung himself. And when my parents called me, I was down the shore, and my friends all brought me home and told me there was an emergency with, you know, somebody else's family, and they pulled up to my mom's house, and I was totally intoxicated when they told me that my brother died. And I remember it knocked the wind right out of me. Like, it rocked my world. And I remember my mom being so mad at me that she said, if you didn't bring this lifestyle into my household, maybe he would still be alive. And the alcoholic that I am, I'm so selfish and self-centered that I made it be about me. And I didn't look at it as about, like, the destruction that I caused in anybody else's life. And I knew it wasn't my fault. It just hurt, you know? So my alcoholism escalated, and it went totally out of control, because the guilt and shame and remorse that I felt, and the sorrow and the heartache of losing my brother was absolutely devastating. So I could not have a sober breath, and if I was sober for any period of time, I needed to go away as quick as possible. I left my job, and I went and worked at a job in a warehouse from 1 o'clock in the afternoon to 9 o'clock at night. So that means I could sleep a little bit in the morning, and then as soon as I got done work, I could go drinking. So the only time I was really had any moments of any kind of being, like, normal is when I was hungover at work in a warehouse, and I would just get different people to pick me up and take me home, because I would always miss the bus, and I was always late. And I stayed there, I did that for a year, and then eventually I just drank too much and just stopped going to work. I did a geographical change. I moved to Florida with my boyfriend at the time, who was into other substances, and he went first, and then I went down there and lived with some friends, and you know, I just got introduced to other things, and like, I worked, and I did pretty good. It was probably the only period of me, like, not being out of control and a hot mess was down there, and I got pregnant, and I didn't want to stay down there, so I was about 4.5 months pregnant, and I came back home. And I moved back in with my mom, and when I got there, I was like, oh, by the way, I'm 4.5 months pregnant. She was like, oh, okay. Like, you know, everybody was like, what? You know, and I didn't drink, I didn't smoke cigarettes, I didn't do anything during my pregnancy. And, you know, when I brought my son home, he was 2 weeks old, and I'll never forget, my mom said, you can go out with your friends on Friday. And I was like, oh, okay. And I went out that night, and I picked up my drinking exactly where, like, it was probably worse. Like, I kept thinking, since I didn't drink for 9 months, that I was going to be okay. And, like, I walked in the door at 5 o'clock in the morning, out of my mind, heating up a bottle for a 2-week-old baby. You know what I mean? And, couldn't even stay awake to feed them. And like, that continued. Like, you know how we do, like, Friday and Saturday, you know, and then it turns into Thirsty Thursday. So then I got to go on Thursday with my friends. And then there's, so I did all them things. I decided to register for school. And I went to school, and I found girls in school at some trade school that drank just like me. And they had their own house. So, you know, me and my kid would go stay with them for the weekends, and then go home. And, you know, and if you told me about my drinking, or that I, like, was really a sucky mom, or if I just had no patience with my kid or any of them things, I just picked up my son and we just went to somebody else's house. Like, that's what I did. If he told me about anything or maybe suggested that I not drink, like, I was out. I was gone, you know? And I did. I took this little boy all along with me wherever I went and would go back and forth to my mom's. And then I met this guy, and he owned a billiard club, and they owned a bar and all these things. And I worked there waitressing, and then I got to manage the bar, so I got to do the liquor order, so that was convenient for me. And then, you know, his parents bought us a house, and I had a car, a really nice car, and everybody thought that, like I had the best life ever. And probably in the beginning it wasn't bad, but, like, we both had our own issues. And it just turned into a really codependent, sick, abusive relationship. And I knew how to get out of it, because if I got out of it, then I would be sick, if that made any sense. And I got pregnant with my youngest son, and I really struggled to stay sober. I don't think that I finally stopped drinking or anything until I was about 6 months pregnant. I delivered my son at 7.5 months pregnant, and he was 4 pounds, 2.5 ounces. And he stayed in the NICU for 3 months, and I stayed under the radar from DHS, and I went to a rehab down in West Philly, and I found me a new boyfriend, because that's what I do, right? I go there, and I'm mad, and I get somebody else, and I complete treatment, and he introduces me to Kensington Avenue, and I justified that I was only down at Kensington Avenue during the day, and I went home at nighttime. So I wasn't really like them people. I'm a little different. And that's what convinced me. Family court sent me to rehab, and I had to do 30 days. And I was 28 days in, and I drank there, and I got kicked out. And I remember there was this woman that worked there, this tech, and she talked about being homeless and, like, eating out of, like, trash cans and, like, all these things. And I remember disqualifying myself and thinking, like, that will never happen to me. Like, I choose to drink. If I want to stop, I'll stop, right? Like, I'm not like any of you people in this room. And when I got kicked out of that rehab and I showed up at my mom's house, like, the doors, the locks were all changed. And she was like, this isn't your home anymore. Like, you are not welcomed here. And, like, that sick part of my head goes, well, bet. I don't have to adult. I don't have to be responsible, right? I can do whatever I want to do. And then the other part of me was like, well, great, what do I do now? So I did. I went down Kensington Avenue to look for the boy. And I went up. It's crazy because that woman's story became my story for the next 4 years. And I stayed out on Kensington Avenue for 4 years. And, like, I sold my hair. I lived in abandoned houses. I ate out of trash cans. I washed my hair in the fire hydrant and shaved my legs. And, you know, I did everything and anything I could to just get one of whatever. And I just became a complete slave. And the justification was that everybody around me lived the same exact way as me, so I didn't seem to be any different. And, like, I got really sick and I had a high fever. And I laid in this abandoned house for 7 days. And my youngest son's father came down. And he was like, you really need to go to the hospital. So they did. Ambulance came and got me, and they took me. And they called my mom. I already had pneumonia like 3 other times. And this time it was really, really bad. And they transferred me to Temple University. And they told my mom to prepare my funeral that I was going to die. And I woke up 2 weeks later, and I had a heart infection, and I had like 3 different types of pneumonia. And I had to learn how to I was supposed to be on breathing oxygen for the rest of my life. And so they did surgery on my leg, and I stayed in the hospital for 4.5 months, and I went from a wheelchair walker to a cane. I was about 90 pounds, and everybody that came to visit me, I asked them if they had any alcohol. And I remember my mom just crying, and I remember just thinking, this is such an inconvenience for my drinking history, you know? And so they sent me to my dad's house in Bucks County, Bensalem, and I was like, I'm not going there. Like, I'm not going there. But I went, and my dad used to take me to meetings. And he would sit outside in the parking lot, like, he would go there, he would read a book in the parking lot, and then wait for me to be done, right? And then I started, you know, meeting women. But in the back of my head, that part of your disease that says that you don't belong here, you're uncomfortable, you know, when you first get, like, that moments of, like, being newly sober, like, you're uncomfortable in your own skin. My head's like, Kensington Ave's not going to survive without me. They're going to miss me. Like, I run some things, right? Not even that important, but my head tells me that I am. I'm so uncomfortable that, I have my oldest son who's about, I guess, 6 at the time. And, you know, he's coming to visit me, but in the back of my mind, I'm kind of really not really there all the time, you know? And, so I go down to my outpatient down in Philly one day, and I decide to not go home. And, I spent like a night out, which then turned into me back in the hospital because I thought I was having a heart attack. And, I slept because my heart was swollen, and it was damaged so much from having endocarditis. And I remember I slept for 3 days, and I woke up, and the doctor and my dad were standing there, and they looked at me and they said, "Were you trying to kill yourself?" And I remember saying, "No, I didn't try to kill myself. Who does that? Like, I didn't do that." And I remember saying to them, "There's this thing that happens to me that I need to feed it, and I don't know how to make it stop. And it's so much bigger than me that I don't know how to make a different decision than just to go down there and do it, right? I don't know how to stop drinking. I don't know how to stop using." And I told my dad that I was going to die from this disease and that I loved him, but he needed to accept who I was. And he brought me back home to Bucks County, and I probably lasted another month. And then I just decided to go on a run, and I stayed out for a week out of my mind, and I was 70 pounds, and I was really in bad shape, and I fell 20 feet, and I broke my back, and I broke my wrist, and I refused for anybody to call an ambulance because I wasn't done drinking until the next morning, and I couldn't walk. And, you know, I had these two emergency back surgeries done, and and then I stayed in the, I was like in the hospital for like a month and a half, and then they told me I was going to this rehab for 90 days. And I remember being like, 90 days? That's a really long time. And my mom's like, "You're homeless. Like, you don't do anything. Like, you can go to rehab for 90 days. And, you know, left to my own devices again, I go to a rehab that's all about behavioral based, and I'm there for a month and a half, and I get kicked out. I went to my first recovery house, and I stayed there for 9 months. And I had a best friend, and we worked, and I really went to AA because I had to go to AA. I went to church because they told me I had to go to church. I didn't change any of my behaviors. I didn't do anything. I'll just tell you, my ass got fatter, and I just manipulated more men, and I was a paper chaser, and I collected welfare, and I waitressed, and I would have told you that I was never, ever going to drink again, and I really, really believed that. We got a house together down there, and it was 2 weeks in. And she said to me, "I feel like drinking." And I said to her, "Well, I don't really know, because once I start, I really don't know how to stop." And she said, "I got your back." And I was like, "Okay, we can do it. We're doing it, right? We're in it." And 2 weeks later, she's like ready to be done, and I'm literally four blocks away, stuck in an abandoned house. Like, that's my story. That's what happens to me, right? Once I put one of whatever in me, I just can't stop it. Like, once I start drinking, I can't stop. Like, it just, and I couldn't figure out what it was, right? And I stayed out for a whole another year of being homeless. I called my mom, told her I was going to die out there, tell my children I love them, take good care of them, thanks for all your help, like, I got to go. And I would go to jail for like 30-something days, you know, call her. Then I'd go to rehab, I'll go to rehab, and they let me get my, they bail me out, or my PO lifts my detainer or whatever. And then I'm right back to where I came from. So I stayed out, and it was really bad. And I was always like, I always had warrants for my arrest and all this other thing. But I'll never forget, it was on the 29th of November. It was really cold outside, and I had 3 sweatshirts on. And I remember not feeling well, and I kept thinking, man, I probably got pneumonia again, because I was like the queen of that. And I said to like a bunch of people that I was with, and the cops were everywhere, and I said, "I'm going to go up to the crisis center. I'm going to the hospital." And they were like, "Yeah, we'll see you in a couple of days," because that's what I do. And but I walked under the underpass to get to the hospital on Lehigh Avenue, and I remember it was the first time ever that I said out loud, "Hi, God, it's Gina. And I need you to get me up this hill. And I don't need anybody to call my name or anybody to stop. I just need you to get me up this hill because I'm going to die. And I really need you to save me today." And I got up the hill, and I walked into the hospital, and I told them that I didn't feel good. And they examined me, and the woman said, "Here's a prescription. You're good to go. Just get dressed, and you're free to go home." And I looked at her with that gift of desperation, right, that moment. And I looked at her and I said to her, "I don't have a home, and I haven't had a home for 4 years. I'm like, I'm going to die. Can I just go to the crisis upstairs?" And she was like, "Absolutely." And And then I looked around real quick because I thought, who said that? Because I would never ask anybody for help, let alone admit it I needed it, right? So like that was like my moment of sanity, and I knew that I didn't do that on my own. And I didn't know what it was, but I knew that I just felt really different. And they did, and they put me into a detox, and I was there for 5 days, and I got some comfort meds, and I threw up for 5 days, and they gave me lots of herbals to eat, which was horrible. But and I kept thinking to myself, when I didn't sleep and I didn't feel good, it was my body's way of being like, how you like me now. You know what I mean? Like, you do all these things to it all the time. And they were releasing me. My insurance said I had a better chance of getting hit by a bus. They weren't paying for my rehab because I had welfare insurance. They were so over me. And I did. I called my mom, and she moved from Philadelphia, which I didn't know, to Bucks County, which I thought was Jenkintown. I don't know what's happening. So I was like, oh, okay. And she took my son, who was 8 years old, with her. And she said, you can come stay here, but you have to do everything they tell you to do. And when you don't do it, don't come back and don't come looking for this little boy anymore because we're done. And I was like, okay. So I did. She came and got me. We still had our house in Philly, but it like had like a sofa and like a tea kettle and a radio. And she said, sit outside, and when I'm done work, I'll come get you. And it was snowing and it was cold. And I did. I sat out there and I cried because I was so cold. And I waited for her. I went to her house and in Bucks County, and she woke me up the next morning and said, I'm dropping you back off in Philly. I'll be back for you at 4:30, because she worked down in Philly. She was never leaving me in her house in Bucks County because she thought I'd rob her. So she said, I'll drop you off and I'll pick you back up at 4:30 and try to stay out of trouble. So I did. I went to an IOP around the corner because I didn't know what else to do. And I signed up for some parenting classes. I found an individual therapist. They told me I needed to be on meds, and I was like, whatever, what do I got to lose? I'll go on some medication, because if you think I'm, you know, bipolar or whatever it is, I'll do it. I didn't have anything to lose because everything that I tried to do did not work for me, you know. I had one friend that I met when I lived in the recovery house down in Kensington that one time when I was a little bit clean, and he would feed me on Kensington Avenue, and I called him and I said, listen, I need some help and I need some women and I don't know what to do. And he introduced me to this woman, and as she said to me, my name is Jen, and I said, nice to meet you. And she said, I'm going to sponsor. She said, do you have a sponsor? I said, no. She said, I'll be your sponsor. And I was like, oh, that's easy. That's simple. And I didn't have a phone, and I had to walk to the payphone every day, which was 3 blocks from my house in Philly. And she had a Jersey phone number, so I clung around with all this change, and then I would leave a voicemail for her. Who I told about resentment. I was so mad. And so I did. I kept calling her, and I checked in with her and did what I needed to do. And she said to me, all right, well, I'm going to pick you up, and we're going to do some work. And I was like I was like almost like a stuck. I got smacked in the face, and I was like, what are you talking about? There's work. And she said, yeah, I'm going to take you through the 12 steps to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I said, holy crap, there's 12? That's a lot of steps. I don't really know if I can do that. And she said to me, I'm going to make this really simple for you. You're going to get with God, clean house, and help others. And, like, for somebody that was so overwhelmed with life, when you broke it down to 3 for me, it was like my brain could comprehend that, if that makes any sense. And so I did. And I really struggled with the word powerless for a while. Because in my head, I was a survivor of Kensington Avenue, and I went through, like, hell and back again. And I was like, I'm not powerless over anything, you know, thinking I was tough, but I really wasn't. And she said, how about you just surrender to the fact that once you put one of anything in you, that you no longer have the option to choose. And I knew that, so I agreed with that. And I didn't agree that my life was unmanageable until she pointed out that, again, I eat out of the trash cans, and I take a crap in plastic bags, and I wash my hair in the fire hydrant. And I was like, good point. Okay, normal people don't do that, so I get it. The big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, talks about when the abnormal becomes so normal, we can no longer differentiate between the true and the false. And, like, it took me a minute because my abnormal life was so normal to me that it took me a second to learn how to live in a world that was very, very different. I was very uncomfortable in my skin. I did not like to be vulnerable. It made me want to cry on a daily basis. I thought I had to be guarded all the time. The only thing that I did know is that when I asked God to get me up the hill, he got me there. So that was like my new BFF. So in my head, I thought of the footprints prayer, and I literally talked to God out loud all day long in front of people. Did not matter. And that's how I functioned for my day, because it was the only friend I had was me and God. So like I was on the L and I'd be like, I don't even know what we're going to do today. I don't even know which way we should go. You know, nobody else cared because they all talk to themselves too. So I blended right in with them people. But like when I went to other places, they kind of stared at me, but then they just got used to me because I told them I'm just talking to God, leave me be. And I had to say things out loud because when I heard myself say them, it was like almost like I could hear the answer, if that makes any sense. And I, you know, I won't go through all the steps, but I just remember getting, when I got to step three, I didn't understand what it meant when they said you turn your will and your life over. And I was like, I'm a visual learner. So if you don't tell me what will is, I got no idea what we're talking about. And I used to say to them, like, talk to me like I'm four, like make things really simple for me. And, my friend said to me, if you were sitting, like, if you had to imagine your higher power, the big book tells you that you get to create one, Gina. You make it be whatever you want it to be. He's like, make it be an image, whatever image you want. Give it some qualities. So I closed my eyes and I did that. And he said to me, just imagine, like, me and you were having a conversation. If you needed to make a decision and you asked God, like he was sitting in front of you, which one's he going to tell you to do? Is he going to tell you what's going to be selfish or selfless, right? Comfortable or uncomfortable? So that's really what I did all day. Like, I try to compare. Like, I knew what right and wrong is. And whatever was comfortable for me and selfish, I knew to do the opposite of it. And when I didn't want to do things and I was really selfish, I would imagine my higher power standing next to me going, you need to get up. You need to get up and go do it. And I would literally pout behind and stop my feet like I was going to somebody. But there was really nobody there. So I just kept following the direction of other people. I had to go to court so I could get visitation of my youngest son. He was 4 years old. And, I did. I finally had 6 months sober and I went to court and I filed for a visitation of my son. And his grandparents showed up with a really fancy lawyer and it was just me and God. That's all I had. And, the last time I filed for court, I didn't show up for it. So, of course, it was, again, they're waiting for me not to show up. And I showed up this time, and I just prayed really hard, and I just said, whatever's going to happen is going to happen, and I'm going to leave it be. And I remember just saying, they said, what do you want? And I said, I just want to meet him. I just want him to know that he's loved. And I didn't leave him. And I want him to know that he has a brother. And I want him to know that he just wants to, if he chooses to be a part of our family, he's four. Like, just because my name's on the birth certificate doesn't give me the right to be called mom. But I just would like to meet him, if that's possible. And the judge was like, whatever. And they said, where do you want to do your supervised visits? And I said, wherever they tell me to. So I did every Monday morning at 10 a.m. at his grandparents' house, at his house. And they set off, like, every alarm in their house when my visit was over for me to, like, get out. And they did introduce me as his mom, which was amazing, and I didn't think they would. And, but I really think that he just thought I was his play date because we played trucks together. And then he'd say, are you going to come back and play with me? And I'd say, yeah. And then he would say to his grandma, like, my new friend mom is really nice. So it was like, okay. And, so his dad was still living there and his dad lives downstairs and, with his girlfriend and they were both still in active addiction. And talk about resentment, right? Like, I had to be sober in order to see my kid, and you get to live with my kid and still be in active addiction. So I was a little resentful. And my sponsor said, it's going to be fine. You're going to keep showing up. You're going to do what you're supposed to do. And I said, okay. And my little guy says to me one day, you know, my dad's going to get married. And I said, oh, that's really nice. You know, I don't pay no mind to it. And the next weekend I go to visit, and he says to me, so my daddy got married, and I have a new mommy now, so it was really nice to meet you, but you can go home. And my first reaction was yelling. And this little boy's just staring at me, thinking, this lady's crazy. I don't want to play with her anymore. She's nuts. And I went home, and I called my sponsor, and I'm literally, like, screaming. And, like, I automatically went to, like, a hood rat moment of, like, I'm going to Kensington and getting peeps. You know what I mean? And I'm, like, going to kill them all and bury their bodies. I'm taking my kid. Like, whatever. In my head, like, I'm gangster or something. Like, I'm the mom, right? Like, I'm taking people out. And my sponsor literally hung up on me 7 times because I was screaming so much. And my sister's a normie, as I like to call her, a crazy normie, I guess, nurse person. And she says to me, I can't believe she kept hanging up on you. I can't believe she kept hanging up. So she's fueling me, right? So I'm like, but I know that she's crazy because she's not like me, right? Like, she's one of the normie people that can hold on to that stuff, and I can't. And my sponsor finally said to me, when I finally called her back, and she said, I need you to pray and I need you to read Freedom from Bondage in the back of the big book. I don't even care if you read, I just need you to read the last page. And I was like, you want me to read? Are you kidding me? Like, I want to kill people. Like, I'm in mode, go mode. So I finally took a step back and I thought, again, there goes that will thing, right? Because what I want to do is cause mass destruction and create havoc. But like, I'm asking somebody else for direction. So I did. I read Freedom from Bondage in the back of the big book, and then it said I had to pray for them, and I was like, hey, we got problems, because I'm not doing that, right? And she said, I'm telling you, just do it. Like an experiment, just do it. And I said, all right. So I was like that little kid that got on her knees and like did that whole, and I painted thinking, like just, like I figured God was like, girl, you better get it together. Like, it was so bad. And so the next time I went to visit him, he said, you know, my other mommy, and he looked at me, and I swear to you, I clenched my ass cheeks and I curled my toes and I said, that's because you're so amazing that you have two mommies. I went home and cried, but I got better, right? And like, they literally would text me and stalk me and just torture my life about how much of a crappy mom I was. And it really knocked me off my square, and I really wanted to throw the towel in and just give up. And then I just kept praying and I kept talking about it and I kept having other women support me in it. Because it was one of the hardest things that I went through in the beginning of my sobriety, was just the part of me knowing that somebody else got to put my kid to bed, and then I never showed up for him, you know? And I left him at 3 months old, and that was a hurt piece for me. And I was very insecure about it, so I just kept showing up and showing up and showing up. And his stepmom was a paranoid schizophrenic and, you know, an active addiction, and she just was really mean to me. And I just kept holding my breath, and I kept praying. And eventually one day I showed up and my son said to me, you know, my other mommy doesn't live here anymore. She had these, they made her leave. And I just was like, and you're funny. You know what I mean? You're funny. And I don't, it doesn't always happen that way, but that's how it did. And, you know, and I just kept still showing up. So I did 1 year of supervised visits. And the second year I got to bring my oldest son with me. And like that was difficult because they wouldn't let me take my kids anywhere and, you know, whatever. And then I went back to court and I finally got partial custody of my son. And, I got to bring him up to my house in Bucks County so he can meet all of my family. He's now 18 years old and, he's at my house every weekend. And, you know, my oldest son's 23 and they're pretty good kids. I mean, they're mouthy kids. They're my kids, you know, so, and they get in trouble. They do their thing, but, overall, like, they're really good and they have a really good relationship, and that's all I wanted was for them to be able to be brothers. And like, I get to, you know, it took me, I had to stay sober in order for that to happen, you know. And I know not everybody gets their kids back and all them things, and for me, it just worked that way for me. And I couldn't get a job because of my lovely criminal record that I had. So, some reason, somehow, they kind of let me, I used to clean the bathrooms down at the Eagle Stadium during the game. How hard was that? I see many, many fun things though. But I did that, and like I would babysit, and like every once in a while I would get like a gift card if I like watched these little kids while their parents did this free parenting class in Bensalem. And I did that. So then eventually I was thinking, I guess I can volunteer or do something. And I went to this rehab in Bucks County, and I filled out all the stuff and I did the orientation, and then they were like, you can come at 7 a.m. But it's over at 7 p.m. Well, I'm like the girl that got it. You have to tell me to be here at 10 and I'll do that. But if you give me a wide range, I'm never showing up. I'm not. I get overwhelmed and I'm full of fear. So, I can't find a job, and like I have 2 years sober, and I'm like, I did the interferon for my hep C. Like I did all these things. I did all my doctor's appointments. I'm doing all this stuff. And, all of a sudden I get on my knees and I pray one day and I ask for direction, and I look up. And there's my badge to volunteer at this rehab. So I have a conversation with God, and I'm like, all right, we're going. You're coming with me. You're going to carry me through this because I'm ready to throw up. Like, we're going to do this. So I park in the parking lot, and I walk all the way through the parking lot talking out loud to God. I thought they must have been like, this lady's crazy. She must be a new patient. Because when I went in to volunteer, they were like, oh, you know, looking at me. So I went into the kitchen, and I volunteered, and I was there for 30 minutes, and they offered me a job as being a tech. And I kept saying, me? Really? Me? She's like, they were like, yeah. And I left and I walked outside, and the first thing I did was, you're funny, Pud. You're really funny. Like, you got jokes for me all day. Like, I asked for direction and I got it, right? So I started a job working there as a staff tech, and I got hired in October, and I got sick. I didn't know what was the matter with me. My legs were getting swollen and all this other stuff. And I went to three different doctors and nobody knew what was going on. And finally, I asked them for a cardiologist. And I got a cardiologist in July. And I went in for open heart surgery. I saw a surgeon in August and I had open heart surgery in October. And I had a little over 2 years sober and I just got a job and my life just was starting. And my mom was like, this isn't a thing. And I'm like, but it is. This is happening. We need to fix my heart. I was in right heart failure and they need to repair one of my valves. And, you know, you sign all these papers just in case you die and all these other things. And I did all that. And then I sat in my bedroom and I wrote letters to my children, just in case that I didn't make it through surgery. And, I remember being so connected with God that I remember saying to my mom, here's the plan. If I'm on, you know, ventilations for too long, you can't leave me there. Like, you have to let me go. You can't hold on to me. And she said to me, it took me so for you so long to get here. And I said to her, the most amazing thing is that you got to see me 2 years sober. You got to see me be a mom to both of my children, right? I got a job and my life is absolutely amazing. So if I don't pull through this surgery, it's because it's on God's time, not yours. And we're all going to be okay with that. And she was like, we're not. I'm like, well, we are. I'm okay with it, you know? And like, I was really okay with it because I just wanted my kids to be together and I wanted my family to know that I wasn't going to die on that up, right? I got the experience and like I did, I was on the ventilator for a little bit longer than I should have been. And, when I woke up, I'm here. So like I woke up and, you know, there was a lot of gratitude and, it was just a big moment for me because I just thought to myself, like, how dare I take life for granted? You know what I mean? Like, I have this one body that I continuously destroyed every single day that has all these nuts and bolts in. My kids will make jokes and they say that I'm like Humpty Dumpty. And I have a scar that runs from my belly to my back from my spinal surgery. And when they were little, they told their friends that I got bit by a shark and they thought it was great. So I just went with it. But I have all these, you know, battle wounds all over me. And they're my story. That's my journey. Like, I can look in the mirror and tell you every part of the devastation of this disease. But most of all, it's like what it did to the inside, right? Like what it does. Like my pain and your pain connect on a daily basis. And that's what keeps our common bonds. Our stories are sometimes the same. Sometimes they're different. It doesn't matter what you drank, if you drank, whatever you did. I just know that, like, the pain and misery that this disease, you know, comes with is what, like, gives us the gift, gave me the gift of desperation, at least just to change. And it's been an amazing journey. And once I finally completed all my steps and I got the opportunity to take another woman through 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, I think that was my moment. Like, that was the moment to watch somebody else change right in front of you that, like, I literally cried and just thought, this is the best game in town. Like, this is so amazing. Like, just to be able to see somebody else's, like, life get better and their thinking change and them just tap into a power greater than themselves. And I don't know. I just kept my feet moving. In the beginning, people would say to me, how do you stay sober? And I say, because I think about my one run for the day on Kensington Avenue and I need a nap. And I'm really lazy. And I really enjoy toilet paper and my refrigerator and my bathroom now. So I don't want to go back to where I came from. Somebody said in a meeting, that God's grace brought me here, got me here, but it's my job to do the work in order to keep myself here, that I have to continuously tap into a higher power. I have to follow the principles of the 12 steps to get down. Like, I have to live this. And like, by no means am I perfect. Never. You can ask my man right there. He'll tell you. Like, I'm not. Like, you know, I have my moments and I think everybody does. But like the best part about it is that you have people around you that love you so much to be like, hey, what's going on with you? I can do an inventory at the end of my day and be like, God, I suck today. You know what I mean? And figure out, make my amends and, you know, do the things that I need to do. Because I don't ever want to go back to where I came from. So I'm going to continuously keep showing up and doing the work that I need to do in order to stay here. I think this is the gift that was like freely given to me. Like all, how it works, Reese, bless you. It says God could and would if he were sought. Like, that pings me right in my heart. Because when I walked up that hill and I asked God to get me there, like, he did. So for me, like, that's a turning point for me. Any other time that I was in treatment, in any AA meeting, NA, whatever it was, as soon as people talked about God, I was like, I gotta go. Like, I left. I left because I wasn't ready for it. And when I learned that I could create mine, like, I'm a Catholic schoolgirl for 12 years. Like, I kept thinking it was punishing and all these other things. And then AA told me, like, I get to create my own and let it be whatever it is. Like, I just thought that was absolutely amazing. Like, how amazing is that, you know? And I don't know. I was in a meeting, and when I first came around, and this man said, many are chosen and few will stay. And you have been chosen. What are you willing to do to stay? And for me, that was like a badge of honor, because I thought to myself that I was plucked from the misery of this disease, whether I was at home, Kensington, whatever it was. It was about that misery that lived inside of me, that sadness, that hopelessness, that just desperation of just thinking, I don't want to die, but I don't want to live, and I just don't know what else to do. And like, I wake up today, and like, I don't live that way anymore. And to me, that's an absolute miracle. And I'm sure, like everybody else here, when you think about your old life and the life that you have now, you're like, was that my life, or did I read that in a book? You know what I mean? Because it feels like it's so far away from you. And I just think, like, that's the most amazing thing out about this program. Like, I am so thankful that I'm an alcoholic, which sounds really weird, but I am beyond thankful that, like, that somebody wrote a book and it gets to tell me how to live, and I have other people that live by it and has principles, and, like, all my answers are there. Like, how amazing is that? Like, it is so simple. And then I see, like I said before, the normies, the earth people, I see, like, my other people in my family that just consume themselves with resentment and anger, and they carry it on, and they hate life, and I just think, man, things are not that deep. I know what misery is like, right? We get to live two different lives than one life. We get to live in the misery, the depths of hell, of this disease. And then all of a sudden, the big book says it, when you tap into a higher power, you get to recreate your whole entire life. It gives me goosebumps. I think that's absolutely amazing. It is the most beautiful thing in the world. And I feel like if I could touch anybody that is stuck in this addiction and just say to them, like, your life will get better. So, like, if you're new, like, all them feelings and emotions and them problems that you just think, my God, what am I going to do? Make things real simple for yourself. I set a list and goals. My mom would give me 10 things. I'd make 4 out of them and tell her she was an overwhelmer and I'm not doing it. Like, I made lists and I would check off what I could do. And I made my life very simple in the beginning of sobriety because it was very, very overwhelming. And, like, now it's just simple. I mean, my days are very full. People always say I'm bored. I'm like, I don't even know what that means. Like, life is just life. And, like, we showed up, and now we have to join it like everybody else. And, like, that's what I learned. When I put a drink or a drug in me and to get rid of a problem, I've now created 15 more problems, right? And then I just keep doing that cycle. So I figured I'll just stay here and keep doing what I got to do. And my name is Gina. I'm an alcoholic. And thanks for letting me share.